with Northern Ireland. They were far more concerned with other issues, like unemployment and the crippling level of taxation. It showed how out of touch Pyra were and how successful the Anglo-Irish Accord was proving. Ordinary people really did believe that London and Dublin could work together to bring about a long-term solution to the Troubles. Pyra couldn't take that lying down, and must have decided they needed a morale booster. Their knee-jerk reaction was the murder on Saturday the 25th of April of Lord Justice Maurice Gibson, one of the province's most senior judges. Ewan and I saw at first hand the celebrations in some of Pyra's illegal drinking dens that weekend. We even had a few drinks ourselves as we hung around. The players loved what had happened. Not only had they got rid of one of their worst enemies, but recriminations were flying left, right, and centre between London and Dublin. The Anglo-Irish Accord, which had done so much to undermine Pyra's power base, was itself now in question. However, barely had the hangovers gone away when Pyra had another disaster. 2 weeks later, at Lough Hall in County Armagh, blokes from the regiment ambushed Pyra's East Tyrone Brigade while they were attempting to bomb a police station. From a force of 1,000 hardcore players in 1980, Pyra's strength had already dwindled to less than 250, of which maybe 50 were members of active service units. Our successes had further cut this to 40, which meant that the operation at Lough Hall wiped out one-fifth of Pyra's hardliners at a stroke. It was the IRA's biggest loss in a single action since 1921. If this carried on, all of Pyra would soon be riding around in the same taxi. The massive defeat of Lough Hall was followed soon afterwards by a disastrous showing by Gerry Adams in the British general election. Sinn Féin's vote plummeted, with the Catholic vote switching to the moderate SDLP. Then, on the 31st of October, during Sinn Féin's annual conference in Dublin, French customs seized a small freighter called the Exund off the coast of Brittany. On board was an early Christmas present to Pyra from Colonel Gaddafi. Hundreds of AK-47s, tons of Semtex, several ground-to-air missiles, and so much ammunition it was a miracle that the ship stayed afloat. The humiliation was complete. No wonder Gerry Adams and Pyra wanted revenge, and some sort of publicity coup to show people like Gaddafi and those Irish-Americans who contributed to NORAD that they hadn't completely lost their grip. On the 8th of November, Remembrance Day, they planted a 30-pound bomb with a timer device at the town memorial in Enniskillen in County Fermanagh. 11 civilians were killed in the explosion, and more than 60 were seriously injured. Outrage at the atrocity was instant and worldwide. In Dublin, thousands lined up to sign a book of condolence. In Moscow, not a place well known for its community care, the TASS news agency denounced what it called barbaric murders. But worst of all for Pyra, even the Irish Americans appeared to have had enough. Pyra had fucked up big time. They'd thought the bombing would be hailed as a victory in their struggle against an occupying power. But all it had done was to show them up for what they really were. It might be one thing to kill legitimate targets, like judges, policemen, and members of the security forces, but murdering innocent civilians while they were honouring their dead at a Remembrance Day service. That was why Gibraltar had been such a puzzle to me. I could see why Adams and co. would be desperate to show their diminishing group of sympathisers that they were still in business. But why risk a repeat of the international backlash they'd suffered after Enniskillen? If they bombed Gibraltar, it wouldn't be only British civilians who might end up killed. At that time of the year, hundreds of foreign tourists packed the squares and streets of the colony, many from the cruise liners that regularly dock in the harbour. And many of those, Pyra would have known full well, are American. I'd never been able to see a method in their madness. It suddenly hit me that maybe I'd been looking down the wrong end of the telescope. Pyra were terrorists, but their presence here in Washington proved that they were also businessmen. There was no sectarian divide when it came to money. Just normal competition and greed. I knew that they got together with Protestant paramilitaries on a regular basis. To talk about their drug, prostitution and extortion rackets. Even to discuss demarcation lines for different taxi firms and sites for gaming machines back in the province. They had the infrastructure, the knowledge, and the weapons to be major players in the world of crime. With cooperation from other terror organizations throughout the world, the possibilities were endless. If so, this was serious shit. Down in the car park, the couple were having a long, lingering embrace. What was going on there was serious shit too. Then one final kiss and, yep, separate cars. I wasn't expecting a phone call from Pat until midday. And there was still about 3 hours to wait for the tape to finish recording, so there wasn't much to do apart from watch Invaders from Mars and Talking Shoes who lived in dustbins. I felt uneasy. I needed to do something. I shook Kelly. She moaned and pulled the covers back over her. I spoke gently in her ear. I'm going downstairs to buy some stuff, okay? I got a very weak... yes. She couldn't have cared less. I was beginning to realize she wasn't a morning person. I used the emergency stairs again and crossed under the highway to the 7-Eleven. Inside, it looked like Fort Knox. There was a grating in the wall with a cubbyhole behind, and a Korean face glaring out and then turning back to watch a portable TV. The shop was too hot, and it stank of cigarettes and overbrewed coffee. Every inch of wall space was plastered with signs informing the local villains, cash register holds only $50, everything else deposited. I didn't really need to buy anything. We had more stuff in the room than we could shake a stick at. Certainly more biscuits than Mr. Oreo. But I wanted some time to myself, away from Kelly. I found it tiring just being around her. There was always something that needed doing, checking or washing, and in any time that was left over, I seemed to be nagging her to hurry up and get dressed. At the magazine rack, another friendly sign said, "No spitting or reading the merchandise." I picked up a Washington Post and a handful of magazines, some for me and some for Kelly. I didn't even bother looking at what they were. I went and put my money through the small hole in the grill. The Korean looked disappointed he hadn't been forced to use the machete I was sure he had under the till. I strolled into reception to collect breakfast. The room was full. There was a TV mounted on a wall bracket above the food and drink collection point. As I started to load up three paper plates, I could hear the anchorman talking about George Mitchell and his part in the Irish peace process. I listened to a couple of soundbites from Sinn Féin and the British government, both pouring scorn on the other side's statements, both claiming that they were the ones who truly wanted peace. A woman's voice interrupted my thoughts. She was presenting the local news, and as I poured an orange juice for Kelly, I could feel my skin tingle all over. She was talking about the Browns. I didn't dare turn round. One of the barbecue pictures could be appearing on screen at any moment. The woman told viewers that police had not come up with any new leads, but that the investigation of the kidnapping of 7-year-old Kelly had moved forward with a computer image of the man seen leaving with her. She gave my height, build, and hair color. There wasn't room to pour any more coffee or juice, and the tray was overflowing with food. But I didn't dare move. I felt as if every pair of eyes in the room was fixed on me. I put a bagel into the toaster and waited, drinking coffee, not looking up or round. I felt I was in a cocoon of silence apart from the voice of the newsreader. I prayed for her to turn to a new subject. The bagel popped up. Shit. I put some spread on it. I knew people were looking at me. They must be. I'd run out of things to do. I took a deep breath, picked up my tray and turned round. The noise of the room came back. No one was looking. They were too busy eating, talking and reading the papers. Kelly was still asleep. Good. I put her food on the side and started to munch my Cheerios. I switched on the TV, muted it, and flicked through the other channels, looking for local news. There was nothing more about the situation in Hunting Bear Path. I attacked the newspaper. We were famous. Well, sort of. A small piece on page 5. No pictures. A police spokesman was reported as saying that they were reluctant to come up with any theories until they had more concrete evidence. But yes, the murders were being treated as drug-related. Luther and co. would be pleased about that. Other than that, there were no new leads. I wasn't the only one in the dark. I had to try to cut all the conjecture from my mind, because it was getting far too confusing. As the policeman said, without information it was pointless spending time and effort trying to think of different scenarios. I determined to focus all my effort into, 1, protecting Kelly and myself, 2, keeping the video on target to discover if there was a connection between Pyra and Kev's death, 3, getting some money from Pat so that I could arrange my return to the UK, and 4, getting hold of Ewan for help in dealing with Simmons, or, if I had nothing for him, to help me negotiate with him. I looked over at Kelly. She was on her back, with her arms out in a star shape, dreaming she was Catherine, the pink one. I felt sorry for her. She hadn't a clue what had happened to her family. Some poor bastard was going to have to tell her one day, and, after that, someone would have to look after her. I just hoped it was someone nice. Maybe her grandparents, wherever they might be. At least she was alive. Those boys must be flapping now. They'd have to assume that Kelly had given me their descriptions and that she'd overheard what all the shouting was about. They must be desperate to get their hands on us. I started to wonder how I could get more information out of her, but gave up on that one. I was no psychologist. If anything, I was a candidate for seeing one. I picked up a bike mag and, by the end, had changed loyalties from Ducati to BMW. Then I read in a fishing magazine how wonderful Lake Tahoe was for men with long Wellington boots, and was lost in a whole new world of hook sizes and rod materials, when all of a sudden there was a knock on the door. No time to think. I pulled the SIG, checked chamber and looked at Kelly. I thought, we both might be dead soon. I put my hand over her mouth and gave her a shake. She woke up scared. I put my fingers to my mouth. It wasn't in a nice manner. It was saying, shut the fuck up. Don't say a fucking thing. I called out, 1 minute. 1 minute. I went through and turned on the shower, came back out, then went up to the door sounding disorganized. Hello, who is it? A pause. Housekeeping? I looked through the spy hole and saw a woman, black, in her 50s. She had a cleaner's uniform on and a trolley behind her. I couldn't see anything else, but then, if she had the police or Luther's boys either side of her, they weren't going to be showing their faces. I looked at her and tried to interpret from her eyes what was going on. They would soon tell me if there were 10 policemen around the corner, bristling with body armor and firepower. I said, it's okay, not today, thank you, we're sleeping. I saw her look down and heard, sorry, sir, you didn't have your sign on. Oh, okay. Would you like some towels? 1 minute, I'm just coming out of the shower, I'll get some clothes on. It would be natural to be wanting towels. I put the weapon in my left hand, undid the lock and opened the door just a fraction. The weapon was pointing through the door on the left-hand side. If any fucker pushed past her to get in, it would be the last thing he did. I opened the door a little more, held it with my leg and put my head in the gap. I smiled. Ah, hiya. The gun was pointing at her behind the door. I didn't put my hand out to get the towels. I didn't want someone grabbing it. All I did was put my hand up and say, I'll put the others out later on. I just need 2 big towels, that'll be fine. And have you got some more shampoo? She gave me what I wanted. I said, Thank you, and she smiled back. I closed the door. Kelly was lying on the bed open-mouthed, watching my every move. I shrugged. Don't you just hate it when people do that? She started laughing. So did I. They nearly had us that time, I said. Her expression changed, and she slowly shook her head.
I know. You won't ever let them get me.
It was 10:30. Another 20 minutes to go before I went up and changed the tapes. I picked up the one we'd been watching the night before, slapped it back into the player and rewound it, ready for its next session. I only had to smile at her, and she jumped up and went to the door, ready to drop the latch. While I'm out, I want you to have a shower. Will you do that? She shrugged.
I get all the good jobs.
I went upstairs to the roof. The weather was still crap. Chapter 21. There was still an hour to go before the midday call. We sat down together to watch the latest footage. I said, it's really important. We might see somebody we know. Then we can give the tape to Daddy and he can find out who was shouting at him. Anybody that you think you might know, like Melissa's dad or the man at the grocery store, or even the men who came to see Daddy. Tell me, and we can have a closer look, okay? I started to fast forward, stopping the tape whenever there was traffic. I logged what they looked like. Male, female, black, white, Asian, and what they were wearing. Black on blue, red on blue. The game wasn't as much fun for Kelly the second time round. What about him? I enthused.
No.
That lady?
No.
You sure you've never seen this man?
Never.
At last, she spotted somebody she knew. I rewound the tape.
Who is he? Mr. Mooner, on Fox Kids.
Okay, I'll write that down. Another guy started to walk up the stairs. I stopped the tape and rewound. Do you know him? She shook her head. I said, well, I know somebody who looks exactly like him. I used to work with a man who could never remember where he left things, and one day we hid his false teeth, and he had to eat soup all week. She had a little laugh, and it kept her going a bit longer. At 11:45, we were still going through the tape and logging. I stopped at two men who were going in together. Do you know either of them? Because I don't. I can't think of anybody who looks like them. I was racking my brains, trying to think of another story to keep her interested.
No, I don't know them.
Oh, all right then. Just a couple more, then we'll do something else. I started to fast forward, saw a figure coming out of the building, rewound and played it. She moved to the edge of the bed.
I know that man, she said.
I pressed freeze frame. I was looking at a black guy in his mid-30s. Who is he?
He came to see Daddy with the other man.
I tried to sound calm. What's his name? Do you know any of their names?
Can I go home and see Mommy now? You said I could go home tomorrow, and now it's tomorrow.
We have to sort this out first, Kelly. Daddy needs to know their names. He can't remember. I was trying to do the psychology bit, but I knew more about fly fishing now than I did about child psychology. She shook her head. Daddy knew them though, didn't he?
Yes, he knew them. They came to see Daddy.
Can you remember anything else about them? Were they smoking?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Did any of them have glasses?
I think this man had glasses.
I looked closer at the screen. He wore thin wire frames. Okay, were they wearing rings or anything?
I don't know.
I tried the color of the car, their shoes, their coats. Did they talk to each other using different names? Were they American? She was starting to get upset, but I had to know. I said, Kelly, are you sure this man came to see Daddy the day I found you? Her eyes were welling up. I'd gone too far. Don't cry. I put my arm around her. It's okay. This man came with the other men, yes? I felt her nod. That's very good, because I can give this information to Daddy when I see him, and that will help catch them. You see? You've helped him. She looked up at me. There was a slight smile under the tears. If she was right, then what we had was one of the people who'd killed Kev coming out of an office that was fronting for Pyra. There was still more tape to run. I tried to sound upbeat. Okay, then. Let's have a look and see if we can see the other men. They were black too, weren't they?
No.
Wait. Oh, yes, of course. We carried on through the tape. I came out with a possible ID of Nelson Mandela, and she saw Michael Jackson. Apart from that, jack shit.
Can we go home now and show this to Daddy? He must be better now. You said so. If we saw anyone...
I was digging myself deeper. No, not yet. I have to make sure that he is the man who came to see Daddy, but not long now. Not long. I lay on the bed pretending to read the fishing mag. My heart was beating loud and slow. I was trying to keep to my game plan of only concentrating on the matter in hand, but I couldn't. Why would Kev be killed by people who knew him? Were Luther and co. the same group? They must be. What did Kev know? Or what was he involved in? Why would he tell me about his problem if he was corrupt? Were the DEA investigating Pyra and drug dealing? Maybe Kev was, and the murders were carried out by Pyra or the drug dealers because of something he had done or was about to do. But why did they know him? Conjecture would get me nowhere. It was just a waste of time and effort. Kelly was stretched out beside me and was looking at the magazine. It was a strange feeling having her head on my chest. I moved my arm around her to look at my watch. She thought I was going to cuddle her. It was nearly time for Pat to call. I got up and switched on the mobile phone, then stood by the window pulling a gap in the curtain, looking at the highway through the rain, deciding my next phase. I tried to think of a good RV. It wouldn't be secure to meet again at the shopping mall. Dead on time, the phone rang. Hello?
Hello, mate.
I could hear the traffic going past the call box. Things are happening, I said. I need an RV.
In 2 hours. Is that okay?
2 hours. Union Station. All right for you?
Union. Yep, no problems.
He sounded spaced out. I'd travelled through the terminus a few times before and could remember its layout. Come in through the main entrance, I said. Go up to the top floor to the coffee bar facing the stairs. Buy a cup of coffee, sit down and wait. I'll pick you up there, okay? There was a long, worrying pause. Is that okay, Pat?
I'll be there. See ya.
The line went dead. Union Station is the main Amtrak station in Washington, D.C. It is so grand and elegant that it should be in Paris, not here in the home of the breeze block and dark wood veneer. At most major railway stations in the world, you expect to find the seedier side of life, but not so at Union. The ticketing, check-in, and baggage handling areas look like part of a modern airport. There's even a first-class lounge. You don't see the trains because they're behind screens, and in any case, you'd be much too distracted by the shopping mall, the food hall, the coffee shops, even a 5-screen cinema. More importantly for me, however, I remembered it as a big, busy location, and because of the Easter holiday, I knew there'd be a big transient population of people from out of town. Who would know nothing of the events at Hunting Bear Path? A cab got us to the station early. There was just under an hour to kill, so I made the most of it, shopping for items I'd be needing for the CTR of the Pyra office, besides the stuff I'd already bought at Walmart. Now that Kelly had confirmed the black guy, The only option was to get in there and have a look around. I bought a Polaroid camera, and 6 packs of film, a pair of cheap and nasty fiber coveralls, more rolls of gaffer tape and sellotape, heavy-duty scissors that promised I could cut through a shiny new penny with them, a Leatherman, a tool that's a bit like a Swiss Army knife, trainers, rubber gloves, batteries, cling film, a plastic bottle of orange juice with a large spout, a box of large drawing pins, a box of 12 eggs, and a quartz kitchen clock, 9 inches in diameter. Kelly looked at it all and raised an eyebrow, but didn't ask. By 1:40, I had a couple of carrier bags full of gear, as well as the books and time wasters I'd had to put in her basket to keep her involved. I remembered the beautiful tiled flooring in the entrance hall, but I'd forgotten the cathedral high ceilings. In the middle was a rotunda shape, with a newsstand and groups of tables outside. Above it, reached by a flight of stairs, was a restaurant. It was absolutely perfect for what I needed. We were greeted at the top by a waitress. I smiled. "Table for two, please." "Smoking or non-smoking?" I pointed at a table right at the back. "Can we have that one?" We sat down, and I put the bags under the table. I couldn't see the main entrance, but I'd be able to see Pat heading towards the coffee shop, because that was further into the main part of the station and upper level. The waitress came to take the drinks order. I asked for 2 Cokes and said, "I'm ready to order now, if that's all right. We'll take a 9-inch pizza. Kelly looked up. "Can we have extra mushrooms, please?" I nodded at the waitress and she left. Kelly smiled. "I am just like my mommy. We both like extra mushrooms. Daddy says we must be forest pixies." She smiled again, wanting a reaction. "That's nice," I said. This was a conversation that needed nipping in the bud. Kelly got stuck into her Coke, obviously enjoying being able to watch real people for a change. Pat was early and wore the same clothes as a VDM, visual distinguishing mark. Either that or the fucker simply hadn't changed. As he walked past and below me, something about him didn't seem right. There was a very slight stagger in his stride, and I knew it wouldn't have come from drinking too much beer. I feared the worst. I carried on doing my checks, covering his arse to protect my own. I gave it about 5 minutes, got up and said to Kelly, "I have to go to the toilet. I won't be long." On the way out, I asked the waitress to keep an eye on Kelly and our bags. Another set of doors took me into the main ticketing and train area. The place was heaving. Half of the USA must have been on the move. Even the air conditioning was finding it too much. The combination of heat and wet from the people made it feel like a greenhouse. I joined the packed crowds, slowly shuffling up to the top floor. He was in the queue at the coffee shop with about 3 or 4 people ahead of him. Very hale and hearty, I went over and slapped him on the back. "Pat, what are you doing here?" Reciprocating my big smile, he said, "I'm here to meet somebody." His pupils were as big as saucers. "Me too. You got time for a Mickey D's?"
Yeah, why not?"
We started to walk beyond the coffee shop, following exit signs through automatic doors, and took the escalator up to the multi-story car park. Pat was a step or two above. He looked down at me, puzzled.
"What the fuck's a Mickey D?"
"McDonald's," I said, as if he should have known. But then he didn't have a 7-year-old on his case day and night. "Come on, mate, get with the program." He started to do a Michael Jackson moon dance. By now we were nearly at the bus station level. I said, "If there's a drama, I'm going to the bus station area, turning right and out of an exit."
"Fine. No problems."
He sounded okay, but looked shit. The cars were on the 2 levels above. We walked up the bare concrete stairs, stopped at the 1st level, and got into a position that looked back the way we had come. I didn't have time to fuck about. "2 things, mate. I've got a list here I didn't fancy reading to you over a landline. I passed it over. I need all that kit. And the other thing, what's the score on the money? He was already looking at the small notebook I'd handed him. Either he was amazed at the contents, or he couldn't focus. Without looking up, he said,
I got some money for you today, but fucking hell, most of it's going to be used up on this gear. I'll be able to get you some more probably tomorrow or the day after. Fuck me.
He shook his head. When do you want all this by? Then he started to giggle as if he just had a funny in his head and wasn't going to share it with me. Actually, tonight, mate. You reckon you can do it or what? I moved my head to get eye to eye. The giggle became a laugh until he saw me looking serious. He cleared his throat and tried to switch on.
I'll do my best, mate. I'll see what I can get on this list.
I'd really fucking appreciate it, I said. Don't let me down, Pat. I really need your help. I hoped the urgency was going to register with him. I was still checking down the stairs. Also at the back there. I opened the page for him to make sure he saw it. I've put a casual pickup. I need that to happen at 2300 tonight. Pat was looking at the RV notes. I bent my knees to lower myself and moved his face over so I could get eye to eye again. 11 o'clock tonight, mate. 11 o'clock, okay. I knew Pat well enough to tell he knew it was serious. He knew he was fucked up, and was trying hard to understand everything I said. I was glad now that I'd put the details down on paper for him. He looked as if he needed all the help he could get. What car do you drive? I asked.
A red Mustang.
He pushed his face closer to mine.
Redder than Satan's bollocks.
He enjoyed the joke so much he couldn't help laughing. Leave via H Street. I pointed away from the rear of the station.
See you tonight, then.
He smiled, moving off. From behind I could see a slight veer to the left as he walked. I waited and checked he wasn't being followed, then carried on up towards the car park level, making it look as if I was off to my car. From there, I took the lift back down to the coffee shop level. I went back towards the restaurant, stood off and watched. Kelly was still fighting with the pizza.
You were ages, she said through a mouthful of mushrooms.
Yes, they ran out of toilet paper, I laughed as I rejoined her.
She thought about it for a moment and did the same. Chapter 22. As soon as we got back, I put the TV on for Kelly and tipped out the carrier bags on my bed. She asked me what I was doing.
I'm just helping Pat. He's asked me to do some stuff. You can watch the TV if you want. You hungry?
No.
She was right. After a pizza the size of a tank mine, it was a stupid question. I picked up the big red and white framed quartz kitchen clock and went and sat on the chair by the window. I broke off the frame until I was left with just the hands and clock face, with the quartz mechanics behind it. By bending it very gently, I now started to break off the plastic face. When there was just about an inch of jagged remains around the center of the hands, I finally snapped off the hour and second hands. Only the minute hand was left. I put in a new battery. Kelly was watching.
Now what are you doing, Nick?
It's a trick. Once I've finished, I'll show you, okay?
Okay.
She turned back to the TV, but with one eye on me. I took the egg box over to the bin and tipped out its contents. I ripped off the top and half of the bottom, so that there were just 6 compartments left. With sellotape, I fashioned a small sleeve running all the way up the side of the egg box, and just big enough to accommodate the minute hand. I called over to Kelly, who was mouthing the signature tune to a soap.
Do you want to see what this does?
She looked intrigued as I slotted the egg box onto the minute hand. The bedside cabinet was about 4 inches below the level of the TV's controls. I positioned the clock on it, so that it was directly below the infrared sensor on the set, and secured it in place with gaffer tape. Kelly was taking even more interest.
What are you doing?
See the remote control? Use it to turn the sound up. She did. Now turn it down. Okay. I bet you that in about 15 minutes' time, you can't turn the sound up. I went and joined her on the bed. Both of us must sit here and not move, okay?
Okay.
She thought I was going to do something to the remote control, and smiled as she hid it under the pillow. It was quite nice, really, watching TV during some downtime, apart from every minute hearing, "Is it 15 minutes yet?" "No, only 7. By now, the egg box, attached to the minute hand, was working its way up towards the base of the TV. When the egg box was upright and obscuring the sensor, I said, "Go on then. Try to turn the sound up." She did, and nothing happened. "Maybe it's the battery," I teased. We put a fresh battery into the remote control. Still nothing. She couldn't work it out, and I wasn't going to explain my trick. "Magic," I grinned. I got out the rest of the stuff, drank some of the orange juice, and rinsed out the container, then made sure that all the electrical kit had fresh batteries, and prepared everything ready to be packed. It was about 10:20, and Kelly was asleep. I'd have to wake her up and tell her I was going out, because I didn't want her to wake on her own and start flapping. At times, I thought she was just a pain in the arse, but I wanted to protect her. She looked so innocent, playing starfish again. What would happen to her after all this, I wondered, presuming she lived. I checked and tested everything again, unplugged the mobile and put it in my pocket, and finally checked my weapon, and that I had some cash. I picked up a half-empty packet of biscuits to eat on the way. Close to her ear, I whispered, "Kelly." I got no response. I shook her a bit. She stirred and I said, "I've put the TV on low, so you can watch it if you want. I've just got to go out for a little while."
"Yeah."
I didn't know if she understood or not. I preferred telling her this when she was half asleep. "Don't put the lock on this time, because I'll take the key. I don't want to wake you when I come in, okay?" I left, went down in the lift and onto the road. The highway traffic rumbled above me. At last, no rain, just air that smelled damp. It was just cold enough for me to see my breath. I turned left and walked in the opposite direction to normal, just for one last check. I munched the biscuits as I walked past the target. All the same lights were on. Nothing had changed. I wondered if the homeless bloke was underneath, waiting with a machete for somebody else to have a piss on him. I quickened my pace to meet Pat on time. I got to the highway and turned right, following the road with the roar of traffic above me. The road swung right and I started to leave the highway behind. Soon there was waste ground on both sides, and the sound of traffic receded. I could hear my footsteps again. To my right were more car pounds. How could Washington be in such a financial mess when the city must be making a fortune on towed-away vehicles? To my left were the new jerry-built office-cum-workshops. I got to the first one, moved off the road into its shadow, and waited. It was bizarre to be only hundreds of meters away from the Pentagon, and possibly right under the nose of the very people who'd like to see me dead. It was also quite a thrill. It always had been. Pat had a term for it. He called it the juice. I heard an engine coming towards me. I looked round the corner of the building, just one vehicle. It must be him. I pulled my pistol. The red Mustang drew up. I was in a semi-crouch fire position, aiming at the driver with my SIG until it stopped. It was Pat. I could see his Roman nose silhouetted in the ambient light from the airport. Pistol still in hand, I walked over to the passenger door, opened it, and the interior light didn't come on. I got in and closed the door gently, onto its first click only. Pat had his hand on the handbrake and slowly released it to move off. From a distance, it's very difficult to tell whether a car is stopping if you can't see brake lights, and that was why Pat was using the handbrake. And with no interior light coming on and no noise of a car door shutting, the pickup would have been very hard to detect. Checking the road behind us, I said, "Turn right at the next junction." There was no time to fuck about. He knew it and I knew it. Pat said, "Everything's in the back, in that hold all." He'd come down from whatever high he'd been on and sounded quite embarrassed. I leaned over and lifted out the laptop. I said, "Is the sound turned off?" When Windows 95 came up, I didn't want the Microsoft sound playing. He made a face that let me know I was a dickhead for even asking. We both laughed, and it broke the ice. We came up to the concrete wall, and, as we passed the hotel, I was careful not to turn my head. We turned right under the highway and stopped at traffic lights on the other side. I said, "Go straight and turn right on Kent." "No problem." The area was urban and now well lit. He kept checking in his rearview mirror that we weren't being followed. My eyes were fixed on the wing mirror. I didn't turn and look now. Neither of us wanted to look aware. There were a few cars behind us, but they had come from other directions. That wasn't to say they weren't following us. I looked at Pat. His 9mm semi was snug under his right thigh, and in the footwell under his legs, he had a 9mm MP5K. An excellent in-car weapon because of its compact size and rate of fire. But a bit over the top for this job. He'd clipped on double 30-round magazines. "What the fuck did you bring that thing along for?"
"I didn't like the sound of your new best mate, Luther. I didn't want him and his buddies dragging me in for a little chat."
We approached another set of lights. "Do a right-to-left switch here, mate. Let's see if we have any groupies." There were one or two cars behind us. The shape of a vehicle's headlights, once it is up close, helps a lot to ID it. If the same shape is up your arse on three turns in the same direction, it's time to get out the worry beads. Pat indicated and started to move to the right. All the other cars seemed to want to go straight ahead or to turn right with us. Nobody was in the left turn lane. At the last moment, Pat indicated left and moved over. Nothing that was aggressive or would provoke a bout of road rage, just a change of mind. We were all held at the lights. I looked at each car in turn, just couples or kids cruising, or so it appeared. I'd soon know if I saw them again. We turned on green and nothing followed. It was now time to talk. Pat started it off.
"Your instructions were shit. You said three buildings, there were four. It's a good job I'm switched on."
He was waiting for praise. "The fact is, I couldn't remember how many. The taxi was driving too fast. I can't count anyway." We were now just cruising. Pat said,
"I've been thinking. Do you want me to go in as your number two?"
That would be good. It would get the job done quicker and would mean better security and firepower if we were in the shit. But I decided against. Pat was my only link with the outside world, and I didn't want to compromise that.
"No fucking way. I remember what happened last time."
We both started to laugh.
"That device swap?"
Pyra had concealed a car bomb in a hide, ready to be used 2 days after. It consisted of 4 pounds of shaped high explosive on a Parkway timer device. A 60-minute reminder on a key ring that told you when your parking meter had run out. They were Pyra's toy of the month. We drove into the Shantelow estate, a nationalist stronghold in Derry. Parked up and made entry into a council house. The hide was a hole dug out of the concrete foundations in the kitchen, with a plug over it and a gas cooker on top of that. We stole the bomb, Pat carrying it in an old canvas holdall. We'd parked up by the small shopping and social club area. All we had to do now was get back to the car, then go and put the bomb under the vehicle of an INLA major player on the other side of town near the Cregan estate. They would find it. We'd make sure of that. Identify it as a pirate device, and then there would be shit on. Great. They could then direct their time and resources into killing each other instead of the security forces and the local population. I looked at Pat. He, too, was lost in his thoughts. Did the car ever get recovered? Don't know. Don't care. We'd turned the corner to walk across the car park, only to find that our car was missing. Some fucker had nicked it. Yet we had to get this device in place that night. The whole INLA leadership had been lifted for questioning by the police to guarantee that the target vehicle would be there. But there was a limit to how long they could be held. There was only one thing for it. We ran. I checked the wing mirror again, then looked at Pat, his shoulders rolling as he laughed inside. I smiled at the memory of coming across two army foot patrols and bluffing our way through. It wouldn't have been easy trying to explain away a holdall full of high explosive to eight very wet and pissed off soldiers pointing their SA-80s at your head, each of them itching for a kill so they'd get the reward of extra leave. It was great to have some light relief. It was even better seeing Pat back on planet Earth. Take us back to the Pentagon City metro stop, will you, mate? I started to prepare for the drop-off and got into acting mode again. He put his indicators on, everything correct, nothing untoward. Nice, slow approach, and into the curb outside the metro. I got out and put my head back in through the open window. Thanks a lot, mate. See you later on. I retrieved the black nylon bag from the back seat. My mindset was that I'd been playing softball with him all night, and now I was going home. He'd just dropped me off after a drink. I closed the door and tapped the roof a couple of times, and off he drove. I suddenly felt very alone. Had I made the right decision about Pat not coming on target with me? I made distance and angles before doing a circuit back to the hotel, arriving at about 11:50. I quickly sorted out and double-checked all the stuff that Pat had given me and packed what I needed into the bag. I emptied my pockets of change and anything else that might rattle or fall out. Then I cut off most of the top end of a bin liner, put in my passport and wallet, wrapped it into a small bundle, and put it into my coat pocket. Once I'd done that, I jumped up and down one more time to check for noise, picking up the bag and shaking that as well. Guess what, Kelly? I'm going to go out again in a minute, but I'll be back very soon. Will you be okay? But she was out of it. I left the hotel and walked towards the target. Chapter 23. The bag had two handles and a long shoulder strap. I walked towards the river with it slung over my shoulder, following the same route as last night. The rain was holding off and I could now see the stars and my own breath. Nothing had changed, except that the lights from the highway were a bit brighter tonight without the mist. At the fenced gate, I used the handles of the holdall to put it on my back like a burgan and climbed over. I'd keep it on my back now. If I was confronted, I could run and still keep the kit, or, as a last resort, draw down on them with the SIG. I got level with the target building, with the waste ground and fence in between. There was no sound apart from the hum of the highway. I started to pick my way through the clutter of the waste ground. It was muddy, Not deep, squelching mud, because the earth was quite hard. But I still needed to take my time to get through. I didn't want to slip over and make noise, because my wet friend in the shrubbery might not be the only homeless person around here. I got to the fence near the Pyra building. Using the bush as cover, I eased the bag off my shoulders and sat on it. The first bound was completed. It was time to stop, look, listen, and take everything in. I needed to be extra careful because I was on my own. Really, this was a job for two people, one watching, one doing. I spent a few minutes more just tuning in. Visibility was a bit better tonight because of the stars. Looking left, the car park was still empty. To the right, the pallets were still where I'd seen them. From my coat pocket, I pulled out the bin liner protecting my docks. At the base of a bush, I dug a shallow hole in the mud with my hands, threw in the bundle and covered it over. This was my emergency cache, my hidey hole, as Kelly would say. If I got lifted, I would be sterile, and if I got away, there would always be the chance of coming back and retrieving it. I wiped the mud off my hands onto a small tuft of grass and started to get myself ready for the job. I gently unzipped the holdall and got out the pair of cheap and nasty navy blue coveralls, probably just like the ones Kev's friends had worn. I was set for the next bound, although bound wasn't the right word for it. The problem with getting over a high fence with a 40-pound bag is that you could spend more time getting stuck and making noise than actually crossing it. I pulled the draw cord from the centre of my coat and put it between my teeth, moving as near to the steel stake support as I could without breaking cover, I then lifted the bag up to shoulder height. Using my shoulders to support its weight, I tied the handles as near to the top of the fence as I could with a quick release knot, throwing the free end of the cord over the top. Checking that my weapon was secure, I reached up, put my fingers through the chain link, and started to climb. Once on the other side, I again stopped, looked, and listened. Only then did I climb back up and lift the bag over the chain link. I climbed down once more and then got hold of the free end of the cord and pulled. The bag came free from the fence, and I took its weight. Then squatting, I watched and listened again. Working alone on a job takes a lot of concentration, because you can't look and work at the same time. Yet both have to be done. So, you do one or the other. You either get on with the job, or you get on with looking. Try to do both, and you'll fuck up. I stood up, put the bag on my left shoulder, and gently pulled apart the Velcro of the coveralls so that, if necessary, I could get to my weapon. Taking my time, I moved to the left-hand side of the building. Before I did anything, I had to defeat the motion detector. I was to the left of it, with my back against the wall. Putting the bag in my left hand, I kept my eyes on the detector high above me, and started slowly edging towards it. When I got more or less as far as I estimated I could without getting pinged, I bent down and placed the bag by my feet. Everything I did from now on would happen on the near side of the bag. Security lights that respond to movement make life much harder for people like me, but only if they cover the whole of the building. I found it strange that there was only one detector, rather than two or three overlapping each other to eliminate dead spots. I was expecting at any moment to be pinged by one I hadn't noticed. But whoever had installed the security system had obviously worked on the premise that only the lower fire escape door had to be covered, and not the approach route to it. It was nearly 1 a.m, which left me just over 5 hours before first light. Time was against me, but I wasn't going to rush. I went the long way round to go and collect one of the pallets. I got both hands in between the slats of wood, heaved it up against my chest, and started to walk slowly. The ground still had a top layer of slush, and my shoes squelched as they made contact. I finally reached the wall, placed the pallet against the brickwork on my side of the bag, and went back for the second one. I wedged the two pallets together. The bottom of the second jammed into the gap about three rungs down from the top of the first to make a ladder. I stopped, looked, and listened. The pallets had been heavy, and I heard nothing apart from the sound of my lungs gasping for air through my dry throat. I climbed up on the first pallet, and that was fine. I got up onto the second pallet, and it too seemed stable enough. I started to climb. I'd moved just two rungs when the whole structure buckled and collapsed. I hit the ground like a bag of shit, and the two pallets slammed down onto each other with a resounding thud and clatter. Shit, shit, shit. I was lying on my back with one of the pallets across my legs. No one came running to investigate. No dogs started barking. No lights came on. Nothing but the noise of the traffic and me swallowing hard, trying to moisten my mouth. Luckily, everything had happened on my side of the bag. I lifted the pallet and crawled from under it, quietly cursing. This was shit. But what else could I have done? Bought a ladder at the mall and carried it to the target. I moved to the corner of the building, got down on the tips of my toes and fingers, as if I was going to do a press-up, and stuck my head round towards Bald Street. I was still annoyed with myself. I could spend all night improvising before I even got into a position to attack this motion detector. Maybe a ladder wasn't such a stupid idea. I should have got one and somehow tried to dump it off earlier on, then picked it up en route. But it was too late now. I stood against the wall and re-evaluated. I decided to react as the situation dictated, which was the firm's favourite get-out clause. It simply meant they didn't know what to do. Bit like me, really. Fuck it. I was going to get Kelly. All she'd have to do was lean against the pallets. She only had to be there for about 15 minutes and I'd be done. After that, she could stay with me, or I could dump her back at the hotel. I'd cross that bridge when I came to it. I picked up the bag, retraced the route to the high fence and, staying on the target side, dumped the bag and coveralls. Then I followed the fence along, looking for an opening to get onto Bald Street. There wasn't time to do the job properly and go back all the way round. I finally found a service alley between two buildings that belonged in some film about the Mafia in 1950s New York. I was straight down it, to the road, and walked briskly to the hotel, no more than 2 minutes away. It was only then that I realized I didn't have the room key because I'd left it in the bin liner. I'd have to wake Kelly. I knocked gently at first, then a bit harder. Just when I was starting to flap, I heard, "Hi, Nick." A moment or two later, the door opened. I gave her a look of concern. "How did you know it was me? You should have waited until I answered." Then I saw the chair and the drag marks on the carpet. I smiled and gave her a pat on the head. "You looked through the spy hole, didn't you, clever clogs? Hey, because you're so clever, I've got a job for you. I really, really need your help. Would you like to help me?" She looked sleepy.
"What do you want me to do?"
"I'll show you when we get there. Will you come with me?"
"I suppose so."
I had a brainwave. "Do you want to do what your dad does? Because this is what Daddy does for the good guys. You can tell him all about it soon." Her face brightened. She was a happy bunny again. She had to more or less run to keep up with me. We got to the alleyway and headed down towards the waste ground. It was dark. She wasn't too keen. She started dragging her feet.
"Where are we going, Nick?"
"You want to play spies, don't you?" I said in an excited whisper.
Imagine you are a Power Ranger and you're going on a secret mission.
We reached the waste ground and took the same route towards the chain-link fence. I held her hand and she kept pace. I guessed she was getting into it. We got to the bag. I picked up the coveralls and said, I've got to put these on because they're special spy coveralls. Her face changed when she saw them. I suddenly realized she must have made the connection with the men who'd come to see Kev. Your daddy wears them too. You'd better be a spy as well. Undo your coat. I turned it inside out and told her to put it back on. She liked that. I picked up the bag and put it over my shoulder. I pointed. Now, we'll walk really slowly over there. We reached the pallets, and I put the bag down in the same place as before. Okay? I asked, giving her a thumbs up.
Okay.
Thumbs up.
See that thing up there? If that sees you, it'll go, whoa, whoa, and there'll be lights and all sorts, and then we've lost.
So, you must never go the other side of that bag, okay? I pointed.
Okay.
We gave each other another thumbs up. I repositioned the pallets and showed her what I wanted her to do. I could hear her making little grunts. She had started leaning as I'd shown her and probably thought she had to make noises, doing manual work and all. I unzipped the bag, pulled out the clock and egg box, and slipped the minute hand into its sellotape sleeve. I gently squeezed the tape, and it held nice and firm. Kelly was still pushing, and I told her to rest. At least she was keen. She was watching me as I put the clock and egg box on the floor and placed two elastic bands around my wrist.
It's magic. Watch me.
She nodded, probably still trying to work out how I'd stop the remote control from operating the TV.
You ready, Kelly?
Ready.
Let's go.
I climbed up slowly, trying to give the least weight and movement for Kelly to have to handle. Once up, and about an arm's length from one side of the detector, I got my wrist resting on my chest so that I had a good, firm support. I turned the egg box so that its long edge was horizontal with the ground. Then I moved it gently towards and about 6 inches below the motion detector, but not going any further than its front. Once there, I rested my back against the wall and my wrists on my chest. I'd have to stay like that for about 15 minutes. I was waiting for the egg box to move up slowly and gently against the face of the motion detector, the movement so imperceptible that the detector wasn't sensitive enough to register it. Otherwise, it would have triggered every time a spider walked across its face. I just hoped Kelly didn't give up. I would find out soon. Now and again I looked down and winked at her.
Good this, isn't it?
She looked back at me with a big smile, or so I assumed, because all I could see was an inside-out coat, a hood, and a cloud of breath. As we both waited for the minute hand to become vertical, all of a sudden there was a single woo of a dying police siren.
Shit. Shit.
It was on the road on the other side of the building. It couldn't have anything to do with us. Otherwise, why just one unit, and why use the siren anyway? I couldn't move. If I did, it would trip the device. And what for? I hadn't even seen torchlight yet.
Nick! Nick! Did you hear that?
It's okay, Kelly. Just keep on pushing. It's okay, I can hear them.
What could I do? I told myself not to flap, to stay calm and think. A shout echoed around the car park. It had come from Bald Street, but a bit of a distance away. Other voices joined in. An argument had broken out. I couldn't make out what was being said, but there were car doors being slammed and words exchanged. Then the sound of a car starting up. All I could think of was that someone had parked up while I fetched Kelly, possibly one of the couples I'd seen from Pat's car. They'd been busy getting the window steamed up and had got caught by the police. This sounded plausible. I just made myself believe it. The egg box was close to vertical. I held my breath. This wasn't a science. We had a 50-50 chance of success, no more. If it pinged us, we'd have to fuck off quick style and take our chances. At last, the box obscured the detector. No lights came on. With my teeth, I pulled the two thin elastic bands off my wrist. I got the first one over the top of the egg box and around the motion detector. Then pulled the back of it tight, twisted it and wound round another loop of the band. I put the other band round to make it even tighter. The motion detector was defeated. I slipped the clock off the box and put it in one of the deep pockets at the front of my coveralls. I clambered down and rubbed Kelly's shoulders.
Good work.
She gave me a huge smile. Still not too sure what it was all about. But hey, this was what Daddy did. Chapter 24. The next thing to attack was the alarms, which would mean neutralizing the telephone lines. One of Pat's presents was a disruption device. A black box of computer technology about 8 inches by 6 inches. Coming out of it were 6 different coloured leads with crocodile grips at the end. A combination of which I'd attached to the telephone line. When the intruder alarm inside the building was tripped, a signal should, in theory, be sent to the monitor station or the police. However, it wouldn't get there because the disruption device would have engaged all the lines. I got close to Kelly's ear and said, "You can help me even more now." I put the clock back into the bag, picked it up, and walked past the fire exit doors to the utilities bank. From the bag, I pulled out another item from Pat's shopping list, a 2 meter square of thick blackout material, the sort photographers use. I winked at Kelly. "More magic," I said. "And I'll need you to tell me if it works." I was talking in a very low tone. At night, whispering can sometimes be heard as far away as normal speech. I came right up to her ear again and said, "We've got to be really quiet, okay? If you want to talk to me, just tap me on the shoulder, and then I'll look at you, and you can talk in my ear, do you understand?" She spoke into my ear.
"Yes."
"That's great, because that's what spies do." I put on my rubber gloves. She stood there with an earnest expression on her face, but looking quite stupid with her coat inside out and the hood up. I said, "If you see any of the light coming out, I also want you to tap me on the shoulder, okay?"
"Yeah."
"Okay. Stand there against the wall." I moved her into position, looking out towards the fences and bushes. "I want you to stand very still. If you see or hear anything, you tap me on the shoulder, okay?"
"Yeah."
"Even if there's only a little bit of light coming from me, tap me on the shoulder, okay?"
"Yeah."
I went over to the bank of utilities, put the material over my shoulders, turned on the mag lights with a red filter and got to work. I'd used disruption devices many times. I worked with a torch in my mouth and was soon dribbling. I attached the clips to the telephone line in a variety of combinations. As they bit in, a row of lights came on, and the aim was to get all 6 red lights up. When that happened, the lines were engaged. 10 minutes was all it took. I rested the box in between the electricity and the gas meters. I only hoped there wasn't an audio alarm as well as a telephoned warning. I doubted it somehow, seeing as the budget had only stretched to 1 external detector. I took off the blanket, wrapped it up into a bundle and handed it to Kelly.